Thanks, Bob. Well, I'm glad the podium doesn't only hold a computer because I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. Deliberately, I apologize for that. I was asked to, or granted the ability to talk to you about 2 weeks ago, and I have to admit to being a little bit confused about how to make the hatchery presentation pertinent to this group. So I spoke with Ron and Bill. We conversed a little bit how to cover things, maybe at least make it interesting, help you understand what we do and what we can and can't do. Under what I'm going to try to do then is explain some of the history of the program, first off. Secondarily, I'll tell you some of the factors of the Alaska program that makes it different from hatchery programs elsewhere. And finally, I want to give a couple of case histories of Chinook enhancement that will let you understand some of the intended and unintended consequences of the things we do. And somewhat related to Dave Cox, sometimes there's a flock of black swans, I think, following us around. We don't find one. I think our world has more than one in front of us. Alaska hatcheries began more than 100 years ago. A lot of people don't know that. They were basically sockeye hatcheries. They were associated with canneries in southern southeast and then the Kodiak area. Now, there was a motivation for these hatcheries. The federal government encouraged the canneries to run hatcheries to reproduce sockeye, and I have a suspicion they did that because they knew the sockeye were being over-harvested in some instances, if not maybe all of them. Sockeye enhancement's rather tricky. It's not an easy thing to do. Some of these hatchery programs lasted for about 30 years. We'd have no idea how successful they were. We have some record of how many fish were run through the hatcheries, but of course they didn't mark fish, they didn't estimate survival. And relative disease problems with sockeye that are rather abundant when you try to grow them where there are other sockeye around, I suspect they didn't make a lot of fish. When these programs stopped, the last one probably stopped more like 40 or 50 years after it had been instigated. There was a break in time between any hatchery programs in Alaska, except for perhaps some small federal research operations. In 1960, the state began to manage their salmon fisheries. You all know the story. Through the course of the Second World War and the time preceding that, Alaska stocks were greatly diminished over time, largely probably because of overharvest, toward the end because of the need for cheap, inexpensive protein for the war effort, and simply they caught more fish than the environment could reproduce. When the state took over management in 60, it thought that the fish would quickly respond. By 1970, it was evident that they weren't going to respond. There were legislators at the time that were very involved with fisheries, and they thought that what was going on represented a hole in the stocks of fisheries out there. And if they couldn't get it going quickly with management, then maybe enhancement, maybe they could fill that hole. In 1968, there was some funding pointed towards hatchery construction, but there wasn't really any kind of a framework set up within commercial fisheries or fish and game at the time to do this. In 1971, a new division was formed, the Division of Fisheries Rehabilitation, Enhancement, and Development. We called it FRED Division. There are still some faces in the audience that worked in FRED Division, and one or two up here at the desk. FRED Division's been gone since 1993, so it's getting to be a rather rare breed. But FRED Division was created, and the main purpose of FRED Division was actually to construct hatcheries, although they did other things, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. Limnology programs were carried on, fish pathology, fish genetics, and literally development of fish culture, intensive fish culture, were all carried on under the auspices of FRED Division. The formation of the division also was coupled with a bond issue for the state for $50 million, and this bond was issued specifically to build hatcheries and hatchery programs. That was quite a long time ago. FRED Division quickly got busy doing that. In 1974, the legislature passed another act. It was called the Private Nonprofit Hatchery Act. There were some legislators that thought that private industry could be more efficient in enhancing salmon, and frankly, they looked at salmon enhancement as a burden to the state coffers, a financial burden. They wanted to develop some way that the users might pay for this task, and this was their way to do that. Private nonprofit hatcheries were granted two things that were specifically user pays that would help. Number one, the regional associations that were formed of commercial fishermen were granted a right, and those associations, remember, were comprised of fishermen. The fishermen could vote to tax themselves for this program. For instance, in Southeast Alaska, the commercial fishermen in the region voted to tax themselves 3% of the ex-vessel value of their catch to fund the program. Now, that doesn't fund all the program. It amounts to a significant amount of money, but today it pays for about 15 or 20% of the costs. What it did do, it offered collateral for loans that the associations might take at a later time to pay for the programs. If you're a lending agency, and the state was the lending agency, and the fishermen are taxing themselves for the program, even if they gave up the program, you could ask them to continue taxing themselves till the debt was paid. The second thing they granted was the right to harvest part of the fish returning from the hatchery programs in cost recovery. We call it cost recovery. Basically, to harvest some of the fish coming back to pay the bills. Now, all the fish that private hatcheries produce are common property fish. They belong to all the people of Alaska. They do not belong to those groups. The only time they can be harvested, in a sense, by those groups is when they enter the special harvest areas in front of the hatchery. So with those two things in place, you have two parallel programs basically working on fish culture, salmon culture, in Alaska. In 1983, at the peak of the state program, there were 20 state hatcheries operated by Fred Division. In 1987, the private sector had constructed 24 hatcheries, and they were operated. So you had about 44 hatcheries going at the time. 1988 was a landmark date. The legislature passed enabling legislation that would allow public hatcheries to be transferred to the private sector. All of the hatcheries at this time, it didn't happen in 1 year. It happened over the course of 3 or 4 years. But all of the hatcheries that could support cost recovery efforts, now all state hatcheries weren't designed with a special harvest area in place. They weren't designed to be able to support cost recovery. All the hatcheries that could or that were specifically efficient at producing fish that were valuable to commercial fisheries, all of those hatcheries eventually were turned over to the private sector, and they were operated by the PNP hatcheries. Now, they aren't owned by the private sector. They're leased by the private sector but operated by the PNP facilities. Hatcheries that couldn't support cost recovery or that weren't particularly efficient were closed. Today, there are 18 PNP hatcheries still in operation. There are 11 state hatcheries operated by the PNP program. There are 3 hatcheries that are federal funded and 3 hatcheries that are funded by state sport fish funds. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the program today, in 2011, and this comes from a fish and game document, hatchery report to the legislature, there were 2 billion eggs taken in salmon fish culture operations, 1.5 billion juvenile salmon released, and more importantly to the program, 48 million salmon harvested through enhancement efforts. That's just to give you the magnitude of the program today. Now, what's different about the hatchery program in Alaska and the hatchery program elsewhere? It's very important to note right off at the top that this hatchery program was started deliberately to put adult fish in fisheries to bring value to those fisheries. It was not started to mitigate dams or habitat loss. It was not put in place to resurrect stocks that had diminished. The hatchery program was put in place to make hatchery fish independent and as distant from wild fish as you could to raise the value of commercial fisheries, and in some part to raise the opportunity for sport fisheries and certainly sometimes for personal use and subsistence. Now, it's different from the programs elsewhere. Many of the hatcheries that you're aware of and we talk about all the time on the Columbia River were put in place because of mitigation. They built a dam, they built a hatchery under the dam, and they promised that they would replace the juvenile fish that were lost with the habitat of the dam or for other reasons. The hatcheries were judged basically on their ability to produce juvenile fish. There's one of the biggest differences right off the top between the Alaska program and the program elsewhere. Alaska hatcheries, if you can produce all the juvenile fish you want, but if you don't make adult fish successfully, that are successfully harvested by the appropriate fisheries, that don't confuse wild stock management, you haven't done your job. So Alaska hatcheries were evaluated by the production of adult fish, not by the production of juveniles. A number of policies and regulations over time were put in place. Some of these related to fish culture, fish disease, genetics, and fisheries management. And I'll read some of these very quickly. I won't explain them now. It would make this a 40-minute talk. It may be a little longer anyway. There's a rigorous public process for hatchery permitting. All hatcheries are permitted through the Department of Fish and Game, and we exist at the will of the commissioner. They do not get permitted or controlled by the legislature or the Board of Fish. But the department has a relatively rigorous process that includes the public sector for any hatchery permits, for changes of hatchery programs, modification of release sites, anything that we do. Second, locating salmon release sites and special harvest areas, they're deliberately located away from wild stocks. All hatcheries and where you collect brood stock or release sites have a special harvest area designated around these sites or a terminal harvest area. And it's fairly difficult to site them, you can imagine, because you can't site this adjacent to any significant wild stock. There can't be any passage of significant wild stocks through this special harvest area. The reason being, when the fish come back from your program to this area, they're totally cleaned up. They're cleaned up by commercial fisheries that are conducted in special harvest areas. They're cleaned up during cost recovery, and your brood stock is also collected from these areas. You can imagine it's relatively difficult to find these areas, but that's part of the planning process. We use local fish as brood sources. We try to select brood sources with fish from a significant stock of fish that has the timing, the run timing, that would come to the fisheries we intend as close to that hatchery site as we can. Now, over time, we started to use brood stocks that we're used to using over a little bigger range, but we're not moving them between regions. We're not moving them between large geographical areas. We still generally use local brood stocks. We legally mandate, or it's legally mandated, that wild stocks be given a priority over enhanced stocks and fisheries management. There are a number of fisheries managers in the audience. They all know how this goes. While you're managing a wild stock fishery, you're asked to be blind to the abundance of enhanced fish. The abundance of enhanced fish cannot affect the decisions you make in that fishery as long as the fishery is being managed for wild stocks. Now, what happens if fisheries coming back to a hatchery pass through a number of mixed fisheries, traditional fisheries that are managed only for the abundance of wild fish, and the hatchery fish aren't particularly heavily harvested? Well, that's why we have the special harvest areas. When they get back to those places where there are no wild fish, we can turn the fleets loose on them. They can catch every fish. If we're doing cost recovery there, we might save some of them for ourselves. Certainly in some instances, we have to take brood stock. Finally, and it's important to that last factor that I just mentioned, all of the fish need to be tagged. They need to be able to be identified. Today we use thermal tagging on our quantity stocks, both pink and chum salmon. They're not 100% thermally tagged today. We're very close to that. Coho are coated wire tagged. King salmon are coated wire tagged. And they're tagged at tagging rates specified by the department. Ron will probably talk about that later. When we produce sockeye, we generally thermally tag the sockeye also. In essence, some of us view the current program as production scale research. Feedback every year is survival to adult, how we've affected the fisheries, and we adjust our programs relative to that feedback, and we commonly change them. So they're not static. We're not sitting on our hands and doing things every year the same way we did the year before. We're continually trying to adjust programs to make fish more efficiently, put them in the place where they're caught by the fleet that they're intended for, collect brood stock maybe easier than we could before. Anything that might come up, we can adjust it as time goes. Now, let's talk about Chinook. That's why we're here. I'd like to present a few case histories. This gets a little bit complicated, but it'll show you, in essence, some of the things you can get into. Now, the first one I'm going to show you is a little bit negative, and it's not meant to convince you that enhancement's a negative thing, more or less to show you what can go wrong for people who have good intentions who don't thoroughly think out a process. We're going to talk about Crystal Lake Hatchery. It's a hatchery that Sarah now operates for Sport Fish Division under contract for Sport Fish Division. It's one of those hatcheries in Alaska that's still paid for by the state. I was recently down to Crystal Lake, and we found some cards in a little box way in a back corner that were inviting people to the opening of the hatchery in 1973. So this hatchery was actually started before Fred Division had its feet on the ground, before there were policies for pathology, fish culture, genetics, before all these things were put in place. They wanted to get the program going quickly, so the first thing they did is they contacted people on the Columbia River, and they moved eggs to Crystal Lake from Carson Hatchery on the Columbia River. While these fish were growing in the hatchery, pathology got its feet on the ground, and suddenly they realized that the Carson River fish, Carson Hatchery, had seen IHN virus. It had been in these fish. There are no stocks of Chinook in Alaska that carry IHN virus. Not hard to imagine. It's not a good thing. It's fairly lethal in almost all hatchery situations, and we certainly don't want it in wild fish where it isn't present now. Well, the Carson fish in Crystal Lake didn't have that, but pathology decided that all those fish had to be destroyed. Hatchery managers at facilities get very attached to the work they're doing. The hatchery manager was asked to destroy these fish and disinfect the hatchery. He didn't want to do that. He couldn't really face doing that. He quit his job and moved to another agency. It's hard on people when you're husbanding animals to ask to kill them all. That's not an easy thing to do. Someone came down from pathology as an interim hatchery manager, ran the hatchery for several years, killed his stock, disinfected the hatchery. Now, Crystal Lake. Crystal Lake Hatchery was built under a small power plant in Petersburg. It's on the road system in Petersburg. The lake is a hanging lake. It's maybe 2,000 feet above the hatchery in a small granite bowl. The water comes down a pipeline. There's a hydroelectric power plant at the bottom. It sits on Blind Slough. Blind Slough is a relatively shallow saltwater slough that goes into Wrangell Narrows. The hatchery was basically built there but out of opportunity. There's a pipeline. There's water coming out of the pipe. It's a good place to build a hatchery. Without much more thought, they did that. They got the Carson fish up there. Without much thought, they were destroyed. Yesterday, you saw some slides that talked about Andrews Creek Chinook. This is when they came into being as an enhanced stock. The Fred Division staff from Petersburg went to Andrews Creek, which is a tributary to the Stikine. They collected eggs from wild fish, and for several years, they brought those eggs back to Crystal Lake. That's where that stock was established. The hatchery got running, and they were well-staffed. They got making juvenile fish, and lo and behold, they had a significant problem suddenly with what's called white spot disease. White spot is not an infectious disease. It's an environmental disease. Accumulation of stressors will cause the yolk in an egg to coagulate or even in sac fry, and once this coagulation starts, the egg is going to die, the fish is going to die, or the sac fry is going to die. Now, what kinds of things cause white spot? Excessively cold water, shock, gas supersaturation. What sort of things can mitigate stress-mitigated disease? Minerals in the water. The water source for Crystal Lake sits in a granite bowl. It's virtually distilled water coming down the side of the hill. It's essentially distilled water. It's very cold. Oftentimes, the water comes down the hill less than a degree above freezing because of the pressure in the pipeline, it doesn't freeze. Those aren't temperatures in which king salmon do very well. We worked with Gary Wiedemeyer, who was one of the early fish physiologists at the University of Washington, and Gary suggested that we add calcium chloride to the water to increase the hardness of the water. We did that. Lo and behold, white spot went away. The hatchery went on for several years, and then there was some request to move Andrews Creek fish to other facilities in an interim basis while they developed their own brood stocks so they could have some fish on hand, start a program, and then integrate those fish with more local stocks. In fact, Andrews Creek got moved to quite a few places from Crystal Lake. The first requests were from Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, and Fred Division sent them some eggs. They got the eggs, and they said, wow, these fertilized eggs, more than 50% of them are dead. What happened, or what were you doing? Well, I said Blind Slough is a long, shallow saltwater slough in Wrangell Narrows. Every once in a while in Southeast Alaska, it doesn't rain. When you get a high-pressure period for more than 3 or 4 weeks, everything is rain recharged there. All the creeks stop, or the flow diminishes a great deal. all the water that can be warmed up gets warmed up a great deal. Well, it turned out that Blind Slough, the temperatures in Blind Slough, were 24 or 25 degrees centigrade. Even over a short term, those are lethal for salmon. The broodstock, although they survived swimming through this water, the high temperatures in the water literally killed more than half the eggs they were carrying. Maybe it killed all the eggs in some of the fish, and some of the fish got through. You're probably better to look at it that way. So basically, we're sending dead eggs to Enstraw that we thought we'd fertilized because of environmental conditions in Blind Slough that hadn't survived. Again, the hatchery was sited because there was a pipeline coming down the hill. There was water available. You could build a hatchery. Before Fred Division had its feet on the ground, and there wasn't much thought in the process. We aren't done yet. 5 or 6, 7 years ago, you've heard about it, talked about it this meeting, it started to get cold. Well, it also started to get cold in Petersburg. There was a greater than usual snow load at Crystal Lake. The water didn't warm up until August. It's hard to imagine fish growing in water that's 3 or 4 degrees centigrade until they got to August, where they actually sometimes reached 8 or 9 degrees, and then quickly in the fall it cooled off again. And it's simply because of the water source, where it comes from. It's surface water in a very high lake that stays cold. Same issue. The fish don't do well in that water. We talked about metabolic rates in cold water. They can't grow. In order for a Chinook salmon to survive when it goes to salt water in southeast, we think the minimum size is 15 grams. We could not grow these fish to 15 grams. Now, some of the fish released from Crystal Lake are released at other sites where they can be reared in salt water, warmer salt water, and reach appropriate size of release, which is about 25 grams minimum. But we were releasing fish from the hatchery that weighed 7 grams. Their chance to survive to adult was very low indeed. For the last 2 or 3 years, we've had trouble getting broodstock back to the hatchery simply because of this. What we did 2 years ago to adjust to this, we put in a heat exchanger using the warmer temperatures of salt water right in front of the hatchery in Blind Slough to warm the cold fresh water coming down from Crystal Lake. A heat exchanger is a countercurrent exchanger where the cold water goes in a long piping system on one side, warm water comes in the other. In theory, the water goes out opposite ends at the same temperature. Now, in practice, it doesn't work exactly like that, but you do get some warming of the water, and in essence, we think we're going to be able to deal with that. Now, we're still waiting for the next black swan, Dave. This was about a year ago that we put in the heat exchanger. In the meantime, when things have been right, Crystal Lake has made quite a few fish. Not meaning to create a bad impression of all these things, probably just wanting you to think that enhancement is not an easy thing to do necessarily, and that oftentimes there are unintended consequences that we have to think through these processes before we put them in place. Now, go quickly to another situation. 1985. 1985 was a very important year for a lot of fishermen in southeast Alaska. The U.S.-Canada-Pacific Salmon Treaty came into effect at that point in time. The troll fleet in Alaska depends heavily on Chinook fishing. The treaty was going to create a great deal of compromise in their ability to catch fish. They were promised, in order to sign the treaty, they were promised that there would be 100,000 new Chinook in troller holds created from enhancement. They signed the treaty. There was $25 million from the federal government sent along with that promise that was supposed to go to build a hatchery that was going to create all these Chinook. Turned out to be a promise we didn't keep. Turned out to be a promise we couldn't keep. We found that even if we were successful in enhancing the population of Chinook salmon, because of the nature of hook and line fisheries, the trawlers in the time frame they had to catch these fish weren't efficient enough to catch the fish. They simply weren't efficient enough to catch the fish. It couldn't work. The $25 million was spread around to the PMP hatcheries and state hatcheries. Unfortunately, most of it didn't go to Chinook enhancement. It went to the enhancement of other species. Regardless, it simply shows you sometimes the intention was to make Chinook to get it to the troll fleet again. I don't think we hadn't thought it through enough. We could make the fish, but with the constraints on management and the ability of hook and line fisheries to capture fish, we couldn't get them into the trawler's holds. There were two positive things that came from this, though, and I want to bring that up. We were able to create spring hatchery access fisheries. We've created these fisheries in the corridors that king salmon use when they come back to the hatcheries. In other words, the troll fleet can be, fisheries can be opened on these corridors, and let's say they catch 10 fish in the corridor. Four of them are from Alaska hatcheries. Six of them are treaty fish. By and large, Alaska hatchery fish don't count against the treaty quota. So those six treaty fish are spent to capture four extra fish. We can conduct those fisheries in the spring in special places deemed by the department to have a high abundance of hatchery fish. And what they've done is they've allowed the troll fleet more time and area to fish, but they certainly have never, we have certainly never been able to fulfill that promise to them. The other thing they've done is we've been able to create, very successfully to create, urban king salmon fisheries in places where there weren't very many king salmon previously, places like Ketchikan, Juneau, Petersburg. I'll go very quickly to the end. Some of the other issues with king salmon enhancement in Southeast, the king salmon never paid for themselves. Cost recovery that paid for king salmon was always done on other species, primarily on chum salmon. Chum salmon are directed at the net fleets, gillnet and troll. They're not directed at trollers. So basically, you're producing fish for trollers, you're paying for them with fish that are made for the net fleets, and that causes some issues sometimes between our fleets. On a positive situation, though, the value of king salmon to cost recovery has never been particularly good historically. Terminal king salmon had very little value when they were caught by net fishermen. On a positive note, again, about 5 years ago, suddenly the value of terminal king salmon increased a great deal. Fish that were worth 20, 40, 50 cents a pound were now worth $4 a pound if they were caught by a seine or gillnet. This had a lot, you can see the change this made in cost recovery, also to the net fleets. And in fact, last year I presented something to the SARA board that showed instead if we took a raceway that was now filled with coho, coho used to be the fish of choice because you could catch up to 90% of them without a treaty problem, and changed that to Chinook, that raceway worth 2.5 times as much as a Chinook raceway as it was a coho raceway. Despite that, we still haven't changed coho production to Chinook. And simplistically, a raceway can be used to produce the same number of coho as Chinook. So they're somewhat interchangeable. The reason being is quite simple. If we make extra Chinook in those raceways, the value goes to the enhancement agency and to the net fleets. It doesn't go to trollers. The raceways currently producing coho, the coho go to trollers. If we change them to Chinook, the value goes to the other fleets. Right now there's an allocation agreement between the fishermen in Southeast Alaska. They agreed to different proportions, value of the return. The trollers are the group that doesn't get their value, so they're not about to change a coho raceway to king salmon, even though it's worth 2.5 times as much money to the fleets. Finally, I'll close quickly now. There have been some general statements about a Chinook enhancement being only a moderate success in Southeast. This isn't exactly true. Over time, we recognize that where you release a fish may have more to do with its survival than the quality of the fish you release. SARA's programs were the southernmost king salmon programs in Southeast, have been stable for about 10 years. We've had what we consider average to good survival through that period consistently. Now, from what I've heard the last couple of days, that's relatively unique. I've talked to some of the assessment biologists on backbeam stocks, and in fact, the donor stock for our brood has also done well enough in recent years. So a lot of it has to do with where the fish swim to sea, and I think you can probably gain that knowledge from listening over the last couple of days. More in enhancement to do with what we've done to create a quality smolt. It's probably more where we release the fish. Thank you.
We have time for questions from the panel. No, from the panel. We'll have time for public questions. Bill, please state your name, too.
Bill Hurd from NOAA Fisheries. Thank you, John. I just want to mention that your story about Crystal Lake and the Columbia River stock that was there that wound up with IHN, we were watching that as it happened, and it was a very good step that was taken. And we're glad we haven't had other black swans like that one.
Thank you.
You're on. I'm on.
Good. No, thank you, Bill. It was hard for the people that did it, but you can imagine. But I think it was the right step, too. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sam Raybung with Fish and Game. I thought maybe I could clarify that since that time, there's been a prohibition on importing stocks from out of state. So that's been illegal since the early 70s.
Yeah, it goes both ways. We can neither import nor export living fish. We did have some special, we did it a couple times specially for research elsewhere, but we don't do it other than that. No.
All right, thanks, John.